Hi, this is Joe Mullen from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and you are listening to Firewalls Don't Stop Dragons.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Firewalls Don't Stop Dragons. I'm your host, Kerry Parker. Today we have episode 372 for April 15th, 2024. And got a great interview for you today. We'll be talking with Joe Mullen from the EFF about the Kids Online Safety Act called COSA, which has been around for at least a couple of years now. It's in a new iteration. It keeps getting amended and changed to try to get it passed. And like a lot of regulations around this sort of thing, it's one of those situations where it's got a lot of knock-on effects that I don't think the legislators are really considering or maybe possibly don't care about. But it's one of those cases where the cure may be worse than the ailment kind of thing. And there are real problems. We'll get into all that today. But before we get into that, just real quick, I just got back from Indiana where I went to see the full solar eclipse. It was absolutely amazing. Everything that was advertised. And I've got to say, I've seen eclipses that where I wasn't in the path of totality that were interesting, but there is just absolutely nothing like being in the path of totality. When that lineup occurs, when the moon 100% covers up the sun, it is just amazing. So anyway, I actually talk about that and my first long distance trip with my EV, my electric vehicle, which was quite the adventure, on last week's Merlin's Musings. So patrons, if you haven't checked that out, be sure to listen to that. And new patrons, which we have several of now, thanks to the promotion, be sure you sign up for that bonus podcast material. That is one of the best perks of being a patron. So speaking of which, the treasure and coin promotion is still going on. The coin portion of that, the Dragon Challenge coin portion of that, will be ending at the end of April. So you have until April 30th, about 2 weeks, before that part of the promotion will end. But the treasure part, the kind of prize chest thing that I'm doing, will continue at least for the foreseeable future. Again, you need to sign up at one of the top two tiers of patronage with an annual subscription to qualify. Go to the link fdsd.me/promo424, which is for April 2024. Go to that link for full details on the promotion. All right, so today we're going to talk with Joe Mullen. We talk about the Kids Online Safety Act, also the Online Safety Act, because it's got some similar aspects to it, which was in the UK. And we talk about what they're trying to do, which is obviously an enviable goal to try to protect our kids online. But the way they want to implement this, the technological or regulatory responses they have for this, is going to end up having a lot of very negative consequences, including, for example, requiring everybody, regardless of your age, to prove how old you are. And in most cases, that will require giving up a lot of your personal information, which will undoubtedly be tracked and perhaps leaked, just to access perfectly legal content as an adult so that we can try to prevent minors, in this case, people 16 and under, from seeing things that we don't think they should see, but also trying to define what those things are is also really hard to do. So instead of me talking about it, let's talk to the expert and get to our interview with Joe Mullen from the EFF. Joe Mullen is a former journalist who spent more than 10 years covering the intersection of law and technology at both American Lawyer and Ars Technica. I'd love Ars Technica. And since 2018, Joe has been a policy analyst at EFF, working on encryption, patent reform, and free expression online. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, I very much appreciate you coming on. I saw an article you guys did recently about COSA, which is the Kids Online Safety Act, and there's a lot of nuance to that. And I think a lot of people just kind of look at that and say, oh yeah, protect the kids. That's good. And obviously our elected representatives want to be doing something about this and certainly don't want to be seen voting against something with a title like Kids Online Safety Act. So, you know, it gets kind of murky, especially when there are real concerns with this. And so I would say at the beginning, you know, I always believe the internet is an amazing tool. I think on whole, it's done amazing, powerful, positive things to change the world. And it's still doing that on a daily basis. But there's also no denying, you know, there's a lot of really ugly content out there that certainly would be harmful to young viewers. And, you know, I want to stipulate at the outset, you know, we're not saying that doesn't exist. We're not saying that any of that stuff is good in any sort of way, shape or form, but it's a thorny issue. And I want to kind of get into those gray areas and nuances today, because it's not as straightforward as I think a lot of people might think it is. So Before we do that, let's do a little background. You know, we've seen how social media, for example, has led to things like cyberbullying and even body dysmorphia in a lot of cases. What do you think are the most serious problems for kids today on the internet? There are plenty, but from your guys' perspective, what do you think are the most serious concerns?
Well, you know, I think, like you said, if you take a big picture look at the internet, what we've seen in the last, 20 years is it's just grown tremendously. So I don't know if it's so much that, the internet just looks more like the world because the whole world is online. So, all the things we talk about, all the things we do, there is always some online version of it. And sometimes, depending on the conversation or the community, the online version of it is the whole thing, right? Whole communities, whole kind of lifestyles and worlds are based around the online world. So just as with, if we had all lived in a small town together of 5,000 people, and then 20 years passed, and what do you know, now we're living in a big city with 10 million people, the kinds of things we deal with on a day-to-day basis and think about and worry about happening to our kids would be totally different, yeah. Right? I mean, it's just totally different. So the really what's happened is the world is online. And so we see all the positives of that. And we also see the negatives of that. And they're unavoidable, right? So I don't think at EFF, when we think about like things that could be harmful to kids, right? It's not the same, right, as asking what would happen in the physical world, because I could think of some of the things that are dangerous in the physical world. But if you think that something is going to be good, make the life better for kids online, it's often a thing that'll also make life better for adults online. Mm. And usually when people try to carve those two apart, there's often, a political reason for it. Mm. The things that would make the online world safer and better for everyone, I think right now are without a doubt, really comprehensive privacy legislation. Mm-hmm. If you want to talk about a law we could pass that would make life online safer and better, that would really be it. And COSA is not that. Mm-hmm. That's our big concern with
right.
it. There's other things that can make the online world better too. I think a lot more competition and choice would mm-hmm. make life better, again, for kids and adults. But that's not what COSA is. And we can dig down into COSA and why we remain concerned about it, even as it's gone through a few iterations. But that's a top line answer to the things that we could do that would make the internet better. There's other issues I work on too. Like EFF has something to say about a lot of different areas, like, the abuse of intellectual property laws, which is one of the things that originally brought me to EFF. And we have ideas for how to reform that too. Even though people don't really think of that necessarily as a per se safety issue, but it is problematic and it does affect our lives online.
I think you're right in that it's kind of like, going from the small city to the big city, but it's an access thing. It's shrunk, like it's a small world after all, right? All of a sudden now, everything that used to be hard to access is now very, very easy to access from the comfort of your living room or bedroom or wherever. That we didn't used to have before. I mean, when you were a young kid before the internet and you wanted to try to find pornography, maybe you're digging through your dad's stuff to try to find a Playboy or something. And now it's just there. In fact, sometimes even if you don't go looking for it, it kind of finds you and it's the access is cranked up to 11. And so I think we're just kind of trying to deal with that. And the internet has certainly shrunk our planet to the size of nothing, right? I mean, everything is right there at your fingertips. So
yeah.
So we do have a history of some child online safety stuff. I mean, the internet, kind of boomed in the 90s. And ever since then, we've been trying to address some of these things. So let's look at some of the things we've already, before we get to COSA, let's talk about things we've already tried and where those stand. So what's some online safety regulation we've already had for kids? What are some of the existing laws on the books and maybe how effective have those been?
Sure. So the main online law that is, really targeted at children is called COPPA, C-O-P-P-A, the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. That's a law we've had around for a while. It's
90s, right?
That's right. And it's aimed at kids under 13. That's where COPPA draws the line. And that's had a big effect on the way the internet has grown up, for some things better, some things worse. but it's the law of the land, and there's reasons to want to enact pretty, you know, strict rules about data collection for users who are under 13.
So what are the basic provisions of COPPA then? Like, what are, I know 13 is a magic age.
So you would need to collect any information from a user under 13, including, for example, an email address. You would need parental permission. So if you're designing a site that's meant to be for a website or app that's supposed to be for kids under 13, you really have to design those kind of permission systems into it. Or you have to really be very limited in what you collect. So like, for example, and you know, I don't like to constantly, you know, I want everyone, every type of family needs to weigh in on how the internet is going to work and how we're going to, what laws and rules are going to shape our society. But I, you know, I do have a four-year-old. And so it's in the past few years, it's introduced me to a lot of stuff that is out there really just as he started talking and being aware of things. That's kind of been my learning process. So like PBS Kids, for example, it just doesn't collect any information. So that's a way to be, you know, COPPA compliant. But there's a lot of services that kids like, right? Like there's kids music that I listen to with my kid on Pandora. There's kids music on Spotify. There's obviously videos for kids on YouTube. Mm-hmm. But it's pretty complicated and difficult to get an account for a user who's under 13 because of COPPA. So that has good and bad to it, right? I mean, on the good part is we don't have kind of wild, intense marketing trying to grab actual information, trying to email, you know, a 10-year-old directly. You know, the downside of it is it does cause like friction when you're using these services. And I think a lot of parents, especially for parents of kids that are a bit older than mine, like mm-hmm. a lot of parents' solution to their 11-year-old or 12-year-old constantly bugging them about the thing they want to listen to on Spotify is the parents go ahead and help them make an account. Mm-hmm. And so someone ends up lying, right? Whether mm-hmm. whether it's the kid doing it on their own, or a lot of those lies do happen with parental oversight, actually, because, you know, they just say, well, just, you know, or it could be use my account, right? I mean, that happens. So a lot of the sites you see, like big internet sites like Facebook, like Spotify, they just don't allow users under 13. And when we've seen them like flirt with that idea, like Facebook did for a while, they had a lot of blowback politically to that idea.
Didn't they have a Facebook Kids thing at one point?
They talked about it, and then they were kind of in the hot seat for all kinds of things. So they perhaps wisely walked that back. But even if they had gone forward with it, I mean, there's a lot of both kind of regulatory, legal, and sort of political and public opinion considerations to doing that. So that's the main thing we have. It's also worth about thinking for a minute about what we don't have, right? Which is, what we don't have is a general privacy law in the US. So, and I think this is like, this is the baseline that's really important to remember. And I think still a lot of people don't know when we're having discussions about online privacy, but the baseline is there's nothing, right? There's not really any rules. Right. There's no general federal privacy law in the US. What we have are, you know, state-specific laws about like what you have to do if there's a data breach. That's mm-hmm. what affects all those letters we get in the mail, right, about mm-hmm. data breaches. They're trying to comply with all these laws. And there's subject-specific laws, like there are specific things that a credit bureau has to do. There's specific things that your health providers and your health insurance company has to do under HIPAA. But there's no general rule. And so the lack of a general rule has led to what we at EFF see as some of the worst stuff that's online, which is you can be tracked everywhere you go.
Right.
You know, and that is really harmful. And the fact is the answer we give very often, kind of all the answers, but let's just to take privacy for a minute. The answer we give to what would make the online world safer and better is really not politically that appealing, because what people want is us to talk about something that would be a specific danger to children and how you could protect children, because that's mm-hmm. a politically popular thing to talk about in certain right. situations. But the fact is, like, people shouldn't be tracked everywhere they go. That's a problem. Like, the, you know, that's a problem with consumer privacy. We have other problems with our privacy vis-a-vis the government. But those things really apply whether it doesn't change that much when you go from being 17 to 19, right? It's right. You shouldn't be tracking 16-year-olds and they shouldn't have online dossiers compiled on them by corporations or by the government. And the same is true of people once they hit adulthood. So that's the kind of basics of what kids do and don't have.
So underlying a lot of things you just said, you said it over and over as you were describing these things, is age. And that is a tricky subject anyway, because every kid has a different maturity level, different ages. And so a lot of times we want the parents to do that. And yet, as legislators, they've got to put a number on it somewhere, right? So that is a tricky thing, but it is there. And so therefore, underlying all these things is the notion of we need to verify the age of the person viewing the content. So before we get into COSA, which has different requirements, how does COPPA actually enforce this? I mean, if you are a 12-year-old and you go to Facebook and you're like, all my friends are on Facebook and I'm the young kid in my class, I want to be on Facebook too. I take that back, because no kid wants to be on Facebook.
It was a really desirable thing, maybe 15 years ago? But yeah, right. You don't hear kids asking to get that. That's websites for people like my age.
Correct. Yeah. So whatever the flavor of the day may be for kids, but there are several. So let's say it's Instagram or TikTok. How is COPPA enforced? Isn't it just self-reporting? Don't you just say, are you sure you're over this? And you give him your birthday. He's like, okay, we'll let you in.
For a lot of sites, that is. And I don't have broad familiarity with a lot of
the law
websites.
Say? Like, tell me how the law works so that people get in trouble if they don't do this. Like, what does it stipulate? What does it say that companies need to do to verify age? Or does it?
That's a good question. You might be getting a little out of my bailiwick about how to do exact COPPA compliance.
But it must be pretty loose, because there's a lot of kids that have it. I don't think their parents are always the ones giving them access.
Yeah, that's for sure true. So a lot of websites do, especially free websites, will do self-reporting. They'll accept self-reporting of age.
So let's get to COSA then, because that's the kind of the thing that brought us here today. So this is the latest iteration of some bills, and there's been lots of bills over the years that have tried to have provisions that are either part of the main bill or tacked onto other bills that were trying to protect kids from the latest boogeyman. So we have this one called COSA now that's being debated in Congress. I don't think this is the first iteration, but it's been around for a couple of years, I think. And it seems to have bipartisan support. And again, I know from an elected representative perspective, it's hard to say I'm against child safety, right? I mean, it's kind of hard to do that. So what are some of the key provisions in this new flavor of the bill, and how maybe does it set itself apart from COPPA and some of the other things that we've tried before?
Yeah. So, and we can return to that point, I hope, that you made before about age verification, because it is part of COSA. COSA really is meant to push companies towards age verification. And there's been a very vigorous debate right now, both in the states and in Congress, about age verification. And one of the reasons, or there is, I think, a misunderstanding about it, that it's sort of like easy or trivial to do age verification, that this would be a really easy thing to do.
Well, we do it all the time in real life, right? We just show them your ID.
Exactly.
We're used to this. This is normal.
Right. And at least not right now. It's not normal in the online world. And it comes with real consequences and costs. So we have real concerns about age verifications, about mandatory age verification, which is part of our concern about COSA.
So is that one of the key differences, it sounds like, between this and previous legislation?
Yeah, this is a real strong push towards age verification, because what COSA does is it makes companies liable. They could be sued or prosecuted if they don't comply with it. There's a duty of care section of the bill. So they have to take reasonable care, which is, what does that mean? It's really not clear, in order to protect against certain enumerated harms against minors that are listed in the bill. And so those are things like depression, anxiety, substance abuse, and a couple other things like that.
Is pornography explicitly called out, or is it kind of
lumped
in?
There's just a new version of COSA that's...
Yeah, they keep amending it.
Yeah, it's been recently amended. But the duty of care section has not changed too much. Sexual exploitation and abuse, promotion or marketing of narcotic drugs, predatory, unfair, or deceptive marketing practices, or other financial harms, patterns of use that indicate or encourage addiction-like behaviors, and consistent with evidence-informed medical information, the following mental health disorders: anxiety, depression, eating disorders, substance use disorders, and suicidal behaviors. So what COSA does is it requires covered platforms, so it requires apps and websites to act in the best interest of a user, and it says that they have to take reasonable measures to make sure that these things don't happen to kids, which sounds good. Like, I don't want those things to happen to my kid. You know, right. No one does want those things to happen. But our concern is that there is really not any agreement about what harmful content means. It is viewed in very different ways in different places in the country. It's viewed differently from household to household. And it's really not clear how you would be able to comply with it, or how you would be able to, if you're responsible for not making a kid depressed, I don't really know how you would comply with that. And it is one of these things where it's kind of like people, including our elected reps, have a lot of understandable anger towards big tech and what they feel are, you know, the power and that these corporations have over our lives. Mm-hmm. And that's really understandable. But there's kind of a short circuiting that's happening where, if you think about some of this stuff, if it were applied in the offline world, it would really be obviously unconstitutional. And I think more importantly, it just wouldn't be in line with our values and what we want, right? I mean, like, if you think about offline media and how it can affect kids, okay, it can affect kids a lot.
Yeah.
It can affect kids enormously, right? So, like, I recently moved to the suburbs. I still live in the Bay Area, but I kind of moved to a suburb. And now, for the first time since I was in grad school, I get the New York Times in paper, and I get one local paper in paper. It's nice. I like getting a paper newspaper. And, you know, my little kid is kind of like interested in it, even though he can't read, because he knows I look at it, and it has pictures, and he likes to look at it. And, you know, I have to censor it. I can't. There's war on the front page of the New York Times. There's death on the front page of the New York Times. And sometimes he sees stuff before I, you know, get a chance to like review it. And he thinks like, oh, there was a fire on that plane or that building. And if it's a story where I have to think about what I'm going to tell him about it, you know, about these hard things that exist in the world. And when is that going to end? I don't know. Like, when I stop parenting, I guess, you know, it's just like, it's here. And before the internet, there was content that was in magazines that was pretty problematic. I think, you know, we were talking about like some of these issues that youth are having with body image. Those did not just crop up with the internet.
Right.
They might be worse.
Right.
Like we're still getting studies in on that, but there's actually not clear data that things like being depressed about how you look is like some new thing that jumped out of a computer. I mean, it absolutely existed when I was a kid.
Like, oh yeah. I mean, the cover models, right? They were way, way too thin and things like
that. We're in advertisements, in editorial content. We just like, as humans, as part of life in a capitalist society, people want to sell us things and they use very unrealistic images of what human beings should look like in order to do that. And you know what? It sucks.
Yeah.
I don't like it. I'm not going to sit here and defend it, you know,
but the internet just made it worse, but it's always been here in one form or another.
And the big trade-off is there's values that are protected by the First Amendment and letting people publish what they want to, and really not having our elected officials mess with that stuff very much at all. We reap enormous benefits from that we probably don't want to mess with. It's probably better off for me to explain to my kid that life is not going to be what it looks like in magazines. Like, things are going to be different. Some of this stuff is not realistic. And we need to have a talk amongst our friends and family and loved ones about how to react to that. I mean, that's like the conundrum of human life. But so I think fundamentally our concern with COSA, I'll wax less philosophical now and bring it back to COSA. Our concern with it that hasn't changed through the iterations is that we're really worried that this duty of care section is a call to censor content online, because people have different views of what it would mean to make a website that's not depressing.
Right.
Or that's dangerous. People have really different views, and we can't censor our way to a better internet or to a better world.
So it sounds like the crux of this is that it all comes down to age, first of all, because there's this magic number 13 that has been called out. And
well, that number is the COPPA number. The COSA number will be minors. So we are definitely
18 and under?
Yes, we're definitely going to be.
All right. So the new med. Okay. So, yeah. All right. So 18. But regardless, there's a magic age that is picked by this legislation. And what it sounds to me, or I'm guessing what's going to happen, is a lot of companies are just going to say, you know what? I don't know what this means. So therefore, I'm just going to not allow access, first of all, to anybody under 18. Because I can't say that I'm not going to depress somebody. So I'm not going to take that chance.
Yep.
But that means that now everybody has to meet this age verification, even if you're over that age. And that has privacy implications, right?
Yeah, it has privacy implications. It also has just like financial and viability operations. Like if you run a small discussion forum, if you want to talk about something pretty serious that could be important, like what if you want to, by the way, I want to just correct myself really quick. I said the term minor in this bill means anyone who's under 17.
And okay.
They might have changed right. That. That's right. I mean, different definitions for different places. So we're talking about 16 and under for COSA. That's where they left it. If you wanted to have a discussion site or have a section of someone else's website where you want to discuss addiction recovery, I wouldn't really recommend just starting a discussion forum if COSA becomes the law of the land, because you could be investigated by the FTC. You could be sued by the FTC. You could actually be investigated by an attorney general in a state that's not your own, that has different values than your own. So just to name a couple things that I think are on the top of people's minds, different attorneys general right now, this is stuff that's very on the record, have very different views about access to LGBTQ information. They have very different views about access to abortion. So abortion is a constitutional right in some states, and abortion, even helping someone else to get an abortion, can land you in jail in other states.
Even just sexual education, even if abortion is kind of a touchy subject for a lot of people, but even just like sexual education or learning about body dysmorphia or anorexia or some of these other things could be to some people depressing, and some people might think that, you know,
And importantly, especially an algorithm, but humans too. But especially the software that's used to kind of differentiate, it's very hard to differentiate between a conversation that is promoting a bad behavior and a conversation that is grappling with the bad behavior, right? So you really have to be a human being with a lot of context to know the difference between like a 16-year-old who makes an online post saying, I can't wait to go drinking this weekend, and a 16-year-old who's making an online post saying, I'm so sick of my friends drinking so much. It makes me feel bad. And I'm not phrasing it in a cool way, but I mean, both of those types of conversations exist, right? Like, there are
The words in those sentences that an AI might pick up on are pretty much the same words, but the interpretation of those words, the nuance behind them, is very different.
Yeah, I mean, there's teenagers who are like, I wish I could go to the school bathroom and vape, and there's teenagers who are like, I wish people would stop vaping in the school bathrooms. And those are just a couple words apart, right? And both of those groups exist. So what are the choices you have if you want to have, say, like a discussion about addiction recovery or another adult type of conversation, or just a conversation where you're either you didn't want minors in the first place, or now you're really under massive legal pressure to prevent minors from coming in. So one way you could say that I've taken reasonable care is that you could have some kind of age gating system. And that's what COSA pushes people towards. And that comes with a lot of complications with it. It is not as simple as gathering an ID at the door, because that can be done. That's a way in which we can actually be protected by the low tech of it all, right? Like the way when you, certainly in California, when you read someone's ID for age verification purposes, it's actually in the law that you're just doing it for age verification. Like the bouncer who checks your ID at the door, and now this is, there's some companies that are maybe not following this now like they should, but they're not supposed to do a scan of it and share it with all their buddies, right?
Right.
It's for a specific purpose. But once we start doing this in the online world, there is going to be a real concern about what happens with that data. And no one should be under the illusion that the person running the small discussion forum, or really any company, even mid-sized companies, no one but the biggest companies are going to be the designing their own age verification systems. So this is going to get offloaded to a few vendors that kind of do this specifically. And so there's a few results from that. Like, one is, they're going to be vulnerable to a data breach. There's no doubt about that. I mean, I'm getting letters in the mail, like we all are, from companies that are under major legal obligations to protect my data, and they still have screw-ups. So that is going to happen. That is going to happen with these ID companies. And the second thing is, there is going to be a trail, a much more clear trail between your identity and the things you read or post online.
Right.
So there's a lot of situations where you wouldn't want that to happen. And that's a big concern we have, that there's no mandatory age verification system that doesn't take away the rights of adults to speak online under anonymously or under a pseudonym, or to really read anonymously. And as you make those trails more clear, you know, you're vulnerable to data breaches, and you're also vulnerable to law enforcement, which sometimes follows the rules of getting a warrant, and sometimes they don't, which is unfortunate. And that's one of the reasons EFF exists, is because we're not arguing for some wild new conceptions of privacy in that realm. I mean, a lot of our legal briefs, you can read them, and it kind of boils down to, well, we'd like you to get a warrant. Right? Like, we'd like there to be judicial oversight on that. So that's not followed perfectly in the US, and the internet is a global phenomenon, right? So what do we do when there's a record on our phone of like, well, I did, which there are kind of already. But do we, how much of a legally mandated trail do we want to have, you know, to people's posts as they cross borders?
So I could paraphrase and summarize what I think we're dealing with here. It sounds like there's three main things here. First of all, there's, because of this new age requirement and severe penalties for providing content that could be disturbing to minors, we have a case where a lot of companies, either because they can't afford to comply, they can't put in the frameworks necessary, because we always think about big tech of this, but there's a lot of, like you said, there's small forums and people hosting their own Mastodon servers and things that are going to be subject to this too. They won't have the deep pockets of Facebook or Instagram or Google to implement these technical solutions. So a lot of them are just going to say, you know what, I can't do it. If you don't swear up and down that you're not of majority, you can't visit my site. And so part of this is, we are now probably then going to be denying access to important, if sensitive materials to minors who may need them, recovery from some of these problems, dealing with maybe rape victims or things like that, that would obviously be bad. But I mean, if you've been raped as a 12-year-old, you might need a support group for that, right? So that's one aspect. Second aspect is, because of the age verification, we are now going to be requiring ID, which means you're giving up your anonymity, no matter what your age, adult or child. And then thirdly, if you're an adult who's supposed to be able to consume this and you're exempt from this law because you're over the age, you're in the age of majority, you are now potentially having your free rights, your free speech rights impinged upon, either but what you can produce as content or what you can consume as content. Does that summarize, I think, the main issues here?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good summary.
Now, I know that some of these things have already been tried, or maybe you're just starting to roll out. Like, for example, in the UK, the UK has been doing some things like this as well. And their Online Safety Act, I forget what they called
it. Yeah, it was called the Online Safety Bill, and now it's called the Online Safety Act because it did pass Parliament. So it's an act.
So has that rolled out yet? What I'm curious to know is, have we seen other places where this has been tried and we can actually point to examples of, see, that we told you this would happen and it happened? Or For one of the things when this Online Safety Act was being talked about, I know one of the early provisions, they may have amended this, but it was like one of the ways you could get age verifications, you'd go to your local pub, show them your ID and get some sort of a token that says you can watch porn. Like, so you had to, goofy things like that. I don't know if that's still in the final bill, but I mean, that would have a really world impact. If I got to go get my bartender to make sure that, you know, that I ask him for permission to watch porn kind of thing. I mean, so have we already seen, because someone else has already tried this, some of the concerns that we're guessing will happen here?
Yeah, I mean, so not yet, but we're going to. So, and the Online Safety Act is probably the premier example right now that I can think of. It just recently passed. And what's happening right now is that the British have a regulatory agency called Ofcom, which is kind of their general media regulator. Okay. And Ofcom is in the process of devising regulations that will make the Online Safety Act a reality. That might take them a couple years to get to a place where they're actually enforcing the law. But if it doesn't get overturned, if it goes forward, we will find out what it looks like. At EFF, we actually, I won't say we just did, we're about to send tomorrow a first round of feedback to Ofcom, giving them some input on some of the things that they asked for, not specifically from us, but from kind of the whole world, all interested parties. They are doing consultations and public comment as they devise these regulations. And that stuff is publicly available, by the way. If people want to see kind of what Ofcom's thought process is, it's pretty interesting. A lot of it's happening in the open. If you look at the kind of questions that Ofcom is asking, it's a wide-ranging government regulation of online content. Some of it has to do specifically with harms against kids, but it goes quite a bit farther than actually even what is proposed in COSA. When you read the questions that Ofcom is asking, a lot of them are just not things that are really compatible with the First Amendment. It's not really things that would happen in the US. And we'll find out what happens when they try to enforce some of that stuff. But I think a lot of it is going to be unworkable. And to the extent that it is workable, we're going to see what we see a lot with sort of poor quality content moderation, which is that it tends to land on people with the least resources or the least ability to, you know, go through an appeal or things like that. And they're going to go really beyond the stuff we're talking about here. They're going to get into areas that have already really been problematic. Like, for example, trying to identify what is terrorist content online. That's really hard because there are terrorists who are promoting their own violent acts. And then there's a lot of people who have reactions to that. There's people that study terrorism. There's people that are fearful of terrorism. There's people that are reacting to it or trying to call out how awful something is. And it's very hard to differentiate between that stuff. And so it's already a big problem in content moderation. And now, and there's a way that it can be done better. EFF has, for example, our Santa Clara principles, which we think are kind of best practices for content moderation so that things get, proper human reviews. So there's an appeals process and it's not kind of one strike and your online life disappears or things like that. And a lot of it is just acknowledging that mistakes do get made and we need an extra set of review. But it's a whole other issue when you have a government and ultimately really serious financial and even criminal penalties behind making the wrong content moderation decision. And that is what we might see happening in the UK.
Well, in the U.S., we also have the Communications Decency Act, which was 1996. It goes way back. And Section 230, which is hotly debated today, it's become another hot potato issue. How does that come into play here? Because that, for those who don't know it, and maybe you could give a better explanation, basically it kind of absolves platforms of content provided by their users. Some of the analogies are, now it's a little bit different. I know that phones are considered a common carrier. We can get into the nuances, but you don't sue the phone company because two criminals planned a bank heist using the telephone system. Or you don't sue the landlord if there's a person in apartment 3C who's selling drugs.
Right.
That kind of thing. So your Section 230 kind of gave some cover, some safe harbor to the platforms over what their users of those platforms might do. Doesn't that come into play here? Doesn't that interfere with what COSA is trying to do?
Yeah, I mean, COSA would kind of blow a hole in 230. And actually, the thing you said about the landlord, I mean, in some, that's not a perfect analogy because, like, we do hold actually third parties responsible in a lot of situations. Like, if people know that there's things operating in a building they own or something, they actually can be responsible. So,
And 230 has some provisions like that too, I think, right?
Right. I mean, but the Section 230 carve-out was important to free speech and the development of the internet because the carve-out was pretty specific and it was like, you can't be sued or prosecuted in most situations, not all. It's a partial immunity from being sued or prosecuted for the speech of other people. It was really about speech, right? Mm-hmm. So that was the thing. It was like, if you're, because people knew websites were going to be just big and public and these big, crazy, loud conversations. And they wanted specifically to empower us to live in the kind of world we live in now and like have the good things that we're all of a sudden kind of taking for granted at the internet, right? Like, well, what happens when you get like a room full of 2.5 million weirdos together and everyone can find their own weird channel. And it's like, wow, out of these 2.5 million weirdos, I found 10 people that are interested in like collecting the same type of stamp as me or whatever, right? Mm. Or an interest that's less popular and maybe you don't want to talk about with other people. Mm. But the point is you couldn't host those conversations if the cops could come investigate you or yell at you or prosecute you because of one of the conversation that happened in room 6B, right? Mm-hmm. Not the transaction, right? Not like the drug deal or whatever, but a conversation.
Right.
And so now we're talking about poking some pretty huge holes in that, like, right? With COSA, it's, you would be really responsible for, well, did that conversation lead to someone's drug use? Did that conversation lead to someone being depressed? Did it lead to, you know, those other enumerated harms? So that's kind of where it interacts with 230. And 230 it's become a real punching bag because of the things we were talking about at the top of the show. You know, the internet has become as big as the world and the problems of the world have come online. They are present and they're in your face. They're easy to see and people are upset about them. But, you know, it has worked pretty well at enabling people to host big conversations without fear. And that's done a lot of good things for the world too. Sometimes people misunderstand the liability, right? Like when the big tech or medium tech or small tech, when they make a thing, a feature or something like that, that hurts people, they can get sued for it. And they do. You know, they can get in trouble when their own speech encourages reckless, crazy, dangerous, violent behavior. They can't, encourages is too strong, right? Like we have to meet the bar of the First Amendment, but there are things that are past it. Like there's a case where, you know, Snapchat made a speed filter or some kind of feature where you measured your speed and it was involved in a serious car accident.
Because somebody was using the feature while driving to show people how fast they were going.
Right. And we said that was a case where, you know, Section 230 doesn't immunize. And
right. That's like free speech. I mean, you can't, everyone gives the improper example of shouting fire in a theater. I know that's not the right, but everyone goes to that. But even free speech has limits.
Yeah. And again, you can look to pre-internet examples of it, right? It's like there was a case where a radio station like had a contest where it was like about how fast you could get to a particular street corner, and this creates car accidents, you know, and it created a serious car accident, and there was liability, right? I mean, there are chains of liability in our society, and it's interesting, I think, when you look at like cases where people were really harmed, like what are the really harmful things in our society, right? It's like cars, guns. Like, it's interesting how we're not having a conversation about those things to me.
Right, like, right.
I think of the things I'm worried about my friends and family being hurt by, you know, and I think about, like, I'm like, wow, none of this stuff is really, we're talking about content,
yeah, you know, right. Like,
but people get shot, people get run over. It's not by content.
Right. One of the other aspects of this that I think a lot of people hadn't, you know, are not considering when they think about, you know, protecting the children and, you know, think of the kids. We talked about privacy for sure. And that comes down to some of this age verification things where there's only a couple of ways currently that we have technically that we use to verify age. Sometimes they make you put in a credit card because the credit card is attached to a record, which has something that can show your age. The other one, of course, is state issued IDs, which have your birth date on them, which obviously if you're uploading your ID to something, that's your anonymity is out the window, not to mention every other piece of information that's on that, including your address, your weight, your eye color, and all these other things that might be on your ID that you're giving up by, you know, proving your age. And another thing we like to do here in the U.S. when we can't get things done at the federal level is all the states have their own laws. And so where we don't have COSA federally yet, we have seen situations where states have come out and banned pornography for people under a certain age, requiring therefore the knock-on effect, the unforeseen consequences now that you have to prove your age. And Pornhub, one of the biggest ones in the country, has since pulled out of states that have had this requirement, like I think Texas and Mississippi and a few others. And they're like, look, we want to preserve the privacy of our users. Therefore, on principle, we are not going to offer anything in these states. And so if we think your IP address is that state, we won't do it. So there have been, we actually have seen impacts of this at the state level of similar kind of age verification laws and denial of access to things that you're perfectly legally able to do as an adult.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. And I mean, I think that there's a lot to the age verification conversation and a lot of things to be concerned about. I don't know about like specific acts taken by specific companies in what states, but the process you're generally saying is generally true. There have been a lot of different states now are passing laws saying you have to restrict, you have to do something to stop minors from looking at this type of content. And so the solutions by the companies that provide this stuff have been like, let's do age verification, let's block off whole states, right? So that creates a lot of problems, right? One is whether you like the content or not, adult content, including sexually explicit content, is protected by the First Amendment, and adults have the right to look for it. And we've said in our country, like for a long time, with some little exceptions like obscenity laws that are mostly not enforced except in some weird places, you kind of have the right to go look for that as okay for adults. The age verification thing, we are really just at the tip of what is going to be a mountain of creepiness. And it's so ironic because it's partly being done by people who want to like clean up the world, you know, and not have so much smut around kids. But the age verification techniques that we're encouraging are just getting started. And some of them will involve things like ID, which have all kinds of problems, right? Like data breaches. Another one we didn't talk about is the fact that tens of millions of Americans, mostly low-income people, don't have ID.
Right.
So like, and some people that's really surprising to, and you know, it may be surprising, but like, welcome to the life of poverty in America. It's not that easy, actually, if you lose an ID to get a new one. It's actually, all those things are actually getting harder. Yeah. So there are people that live without ID, and we're saying, we're not just talking about cutting people off of like their favorite porn site. Like, when you have a large, diverse site with all kinds of different conversations, some of the conversations will be sensitive and you might start IDing people, and then you're IDing people for everything. And you might be IDing people a lot. You know, people have a lot of conversations that are about things they need to do in their life. People have conversations about how to find a job, about how to find housing, about other things that we've always thought are protected. And that, yes, actually, people need to be able to do without pulling out an ID, which they might not have. So that's also an important point. On the creepiness factor, people are going to be doing biometric stuff. They're already working on it, right? The biometric companies want to be able to scan us and then market those abilities, market that data. So when you create a legal regime in which people can get in trouble for having 16-year-olds on their site, they might scan ID and they might also and or get sold on the idea of a newfangled biometric company that promises to be able to scan us and look at our pictures.
Oh, they're doing that now. There are some age verification sites that do it through AI. Like, by looking at your face, I can roughly figure out how old you are and whether or not you're a minor.
Right, right. I mean, that's not like checking ID at the door. That's like walk around and stare into the face of, you know, especially the youngest looking people. I mean, how creepy can we get here where we're going to, you know, let's go around the library and, you know, scan everyone's face and, yeah, or the, anywhere you might have a conversation, right? The supermarket, I don't know, the football stadium, like,
oh yeah,
we don't really want people or software to constantly be going around and, you know, scanning, analyzing, figuring out who's what age. It creates these new troves of data that are going to be subject to abuse.
Are congressional representatives doing an adequate job in your estimation, or I don't know if you want to give your personal opinion or the EFF's stance or both, but at reaching out to civil rights groups like yourself, like EFF, like others, to get input as they draft and amend these things, how much are they paying attention to that? Do they seek it out, or do they just wait for you to squeal and then they listen? And then what about doctors and psychologists and things? Are they basing some of this law on accepted expert testimony?
I wish we'd get listened to it more. I don't think we are not listened to. They do listen to us. Groups like EFF and other members of civil society do have real influence on the process. We're going to oppose COSA. I don't really see an iteration of this where we go neutral, because it's fundamentally a censorship law. The core meat of that law is the duty of care. It hasn't changed that much. They've changed who the enforcers are and other things like that. But listen, they have listened. It's actually better. It's better than the bill that was a year ago. It's not good enough for us to support it. But we do get listened to, but, you know, we don't win every battle. I think a problem that EFF is dealing with is that it's just a lot less cool and interesting to say you're fighting for free speech than it was 10 years ago. Not to me, but I think people tend to, the problem is a lot of people, there are, you know, people have develop real associations between that term and what I would loosely call like hate speech or different kinds of discriminatory or racist speech, which is a bummer because that's super bad marketing for what I think is a good cause. And then there is a general anger at the internet. There's kind of the tech lash continues to be underway. And so I think those things are fused together to make us get things like COSA. You know, when you look at the history of, for example, the Online Safety Act, one thing that happened there was they gave out a lot of, you know, essentially exemptions, like either implicitly or explicitly, right? So we actually opposed the online safety bill because we thought it was going to push people to scan all messages, including encrypted messages, which is a battle, another battle we have to fight and refight every year, which is people say, well, because of child sexual abuse imagery, because of, you know, this illegal category of content, we need to look for it. And the way to look for it is to scan everything all the time.
Right.
And so that presents a threat to encryption. And we say, well, there's no backdoor that works just for good guys. It's a constant thing that EFF has been saying way before I joined EFF. I mean, this is like one of the foundational battles, right? We've been fighting the crypto wars, and I don't mean cryptocurrency.
Right.
since since the 90s. We still thought that about the online safety bill right up to the point of passage. Now we see in some ways the regulator is kind of backing away from that and saying, this is not going to apply to encrypted messages. And I don't know what's going to happen, but that's actually some of the things we're asking in our feedback for this week, which is we're saying, if you mean this, you have to make it clear because you can't just go halfway. But one way that some of this stuff gets passed is like, they give exemptions to example for like people that provide encrypted messages to like defense industries, right? Sure. To national defense, because they say, well, actually we can't, right? I mean, it would be really dangerous to have a system where you're scanning, where a company that provides encrypted messaging to like your own army, or say the Ukrainian army, which an actual UK company does.
Or government representatives and elected representatives, they should have privacy, shouldn't we? But then, of course, we
absolutely. Should all have privacy. Like, imagine the extortion and the national security implications. Right. If there's just one office of a scanning company where we're going to, do you think someone might want to socially engineer their way into that office? Mm-hmm. Like, some of the ways that they exempt those groups, like the in the UK, they kind of were able to say convincingly, oh, well, there's a national security defense, like, exemption. We're not going to go after them.
Right.
So that, you know, we lose potential allies like that.
All right. So I saved the hardest two questions for last. And that is two forms of what can we do about this? So first of all, is there anything in COSA that EFF thinks is salvageable? Is there something good in there? But more broadly, from a legislative perspective, how should Congress try to address this, if at all? What do we need to go beyond what we have today? Does EFF support any level of, or do they have any better ideas for regulations that we could put around this sort of thing to help protect kids online?
Yeah, I mean, I think a thing we could do is we could have real comprehensive privacy legislation that includes a private right of action and that it applies to everyone. We don't need to be tracked everywhere we go online. I mean, that's a real safety concern and a privacy concern. So and it is possible to write a privacy bill that complies with the First Amendment, right? I mean, some states are working on it. California has a bill that still is like a work in progress. There's some things we like about that and some things that could be a lot better, but you can do it without, you know, going the censorship route. It is possible to do that while complying with the First Amendment. And we could also, there's some behaviors that we could take off the table completely. Like, we don't need to have targeted advertising. And when I say targeted, I mean behavioral tracking ads, an ad that watches you, right? The kind of targeting we should have is like, well, I want to put my ad in the entertainment section because I want to reach those readers. You don't, you know, when I open the entertainment section of the New York Times in paper, it doesn't ask me what I read before and after and what I'm going to read later tonight. So yeah, I think those are things that we could do to make the online world better. And we could also, there is a bigger picture battle that I think will take longer. And there's a lot of, even the early thinking on it is not done, but we could use antitrust law in a more vigorous way to stop the internet from being just, you know, four or five companies all talking about each other. We could start that process, and I'm, you know, it doesn't have to be a giant break it all up lawsuit starting tomorrow. Although litigation, antitrust litigation might play a useful role at some point. But we could start by just saying, well, really have merger scrutiny. Like, if you're one of the largest companies on the internet, do you need to be able to buy 35 other companies in a year? Or should...
Including potential competitors, yeah.
Exactly. Or should we have a system where we says, well, you offer one set of choices to people, including parents, but including everyone, and maybe we'd like consumers to have, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 or 10, 20 choices about how to moderate this content down the road. And I think reinvigorated antitrust with a more thorough, starting with more thorough reviews of things like mergers could create in the long run more choice. And I think that'll help because part of this is the part of this where there's no easy answer is within families, I think there is like a job when you're talking about minors, there is a job that like I, as a parent, will never get relieved from. And you actually don't want the government to come replace you. Like, it's not going to work. People have different views about like a lot of stuff. Like, it's not just the kind of content even in mentioning COSA, but like there's things that are dangerous in the world of sports, in the world of, you know, the transportation you use to get around. Like, there's a lot of questions that there's just not going to be. We live in too big and diverse of a society for us to want top-down regulation on it.
So what I didn't hear is any mention of doing anything based on age. And that may be because that's just too hard to do. And maybe that leads to the second half of the tough question. It is, what do we tell parents? The parents today, I'm a technologist. I could, and I did with my kids as best I could, you know, have parental controls on their devices and things like that. But kids are smart. They figure this stuff out. You know, kid, if a kid can figure out how to do a VPN to get past something or skip biometrics to get past something else, they're going to share it with their friends. And they get, you know, kids are really clever and very motivated in a lot of cases to work around some of these age restrictions. But yeah, so what's a parent to do, especially one that maybe not doesn't feel as technologically inclined? What, how can they best protect their kids? And maybe this goes all the way back to the beginning where I think you mentioned we got to talk to the kids, right? I mean, so there's got to be conversations that your role as a parent has changed, but fundamentally, a lot of it comes down to you. So I don't want to answer the question for you, but what is your advice to parents today who feel like they want to have more control over their kids because they do want to set the values and the access for their kids and the way they see fit for their family?
Yeah. I'll give a personal and honest answer to that as like the parent of a four-year-old, which is I feel you and I am learning it day by day. And like when it comes to like the answers I use this year are different than what I used last year. And especially at these young ages, kids change so much. You know, I'll be asking different questions at when he's five. I'll be asking way sure. different questions when he's 12, when he's 14. And what I'm going to do is I'm stuck. Like there's no technological fix. The technological fix is to have conversations and learn. And I have a lot of friends who are parents of older kids, and that's my personal answer as a parent. It's like, I see this road and there's no easy way out of it, right? And there is no technological quick fix. Are there going to be products that could help? For sure. And we want there to be a wide, now we, you know, speaking as EFF, like we want there to be kind of a wide array of stuff to choose from so that we can hopefully elevate the good things and weed out some of the bad stuff. Which is, you know, part of why we have a vigorous free press, a lot of reviews and a lot of online conversations can help with that stuff. So yeah, I'm learning it as I go along. Like it's something I do a lot of research on personally. And I think about a lot too.
Have you found any good resources? Are there, I know Common Sense Media is one that a lot of parents go to. Have you found any worthwhile resources for parents that are trying to help figure out how to protect their kids online?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I'm learning it day by day. Like this is my life hack that I'll share with you. It's not original to me, but I just found out that, on Netflix, I'm a Netflix customer. There's like, you can make it so that specific shows don't show up in your kids' feed. And I was like, oh, that's a good feature. I wish other places had that feature. And I find this kind of humorous because I'm like, I'm giving you censorship tips as an EFF employee. I'm like, but I'm like interested in it, right? I'm like, what's the top? And I, honestly, I've had some funny conversations with coworkers and friends about it. It's like some of us, you know, I definitely censor some stuff because I think it kind of showcases like fighting or things that I think my kid at his age right now is like too hard to explain, right? And he wouldn't understand it. And so I don't want him to see shows that feature that. And then honestly, I also do what a lot of other parents do. And I just censor stuff that's like really annoying. Like sometimes people just are like, oh, Blippi, that doesn't exist. Like, you know,
for me, it was the Teletubbies. I did not show my kids Teletubbies.
Yeah.
It drove me crazy.
Yeah. And this isn't my personal, the bane of my personal existence, but like I have a parent friend who's like Cocomelon out. Like I never want to hear that. So I think it's funny that I was like, wow, you know, I work at a free speech organization. I'm like, I'm very interested in these.
Well, at your personal censorship. Family level, that's a different thing, right?
It is. Yeah. And it's also like, it actually makes more of a difference than you think, I think, to ask for the features you want, right? Like, and when we talk, you can also think about, we're kind of talking on like a humorous level, or like content we find just like annoying or not appropriate for little kids. But you know, also like when in the encryption context, sometimes people ask us, well, what do you do, right? If there's a encrypted conversation and if there's end-to-end encryption, the authorities can't get it, right? It's like, oh my God, what could you do? Well, actually, you could have a good reporting mechanism. That's actually something you could ask for to be better, that the company provides an encrypted service, because a lot of the times, you know how stuff that's harmful like gets out? It's because a person speaks up and says, I'm harmed by this. Like, that is how you get it, right? Like, there's two ends to an end-to-end encrypted conversation, and people are acting like, oh, the good guys will never see it. All this stuff will happen behind closed doors. Actually, the good guys do get copies of the conversation all the time. They
ask. Somebody reported it, yeah.
Yeah, that's how investigations work. You ask, and you find out when there is a victim, boy, oh boy, can they speak up. And so from everything from the big things in life, like being a victim of something, to something where it's like, hey, I would like better control over my online life, like speak up about it, I think. That's also a way that we can make change, you know, speak within our communities and our social networks.
Well, and as a parent, it's end-to-end encryption, but you own the end. You bought that for the kid. Like, that is your, that endpoint is your device. So put your fingerprint on it, put your face ID on it, and make an arrangement with your kids. Like, look, I can, you know, I can inspect your phone at any time, and I'll tell you before I do it. But I mean, that is part of our agreement for you to have this device, is that I, as a parent, have to have oversight, and I can put in parental controls, which means that, like, even just with Netflix, that's why we have profiles. Everybody should have a profile, and you could have certain profiles with certain restrictions and others not. And as a parent, you should have control over that. I mean, these are some of the technological solutions that we can employ.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that. And things change every year, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
when different kids are different ages, and the world changes. Yeah, oh yeah, it's very fluid.
So I think on both, I kind of sidetracked us a bit into encryption there, but I think on a lot of different levels, there are systems that worked before the internet, you know, and they still work pretty well, right? Like having conversations with people, like being transparent about what you do and don't want to watch within your family, and then having good features, good controls, good reporting mechanisms. Those are all things we could work on. But some of those things we could improve without the help of our friendly legislators. So sometimes they want something more to do than that. But our answer is not do nothing. You know, there is good legislation to be done. We think that too. And better competition and better privacy are things that can happen.
Well, I'm sure we've solved all the problems. Thank you for coming on the show. If they would only listen to us, we could fix this. Thank you for all the discussion today. It was very enlightening.
Thanks a lot, Kerry. I had a lot of fun being here.
Big thanks again to Joe for coming on the show. This is a really important topic, and there's a lot of nuance to this that I don't think gets covered. It's so easy to just look at the sound bites and protect the children and, you know, think of the kids. You know, that's an easy go-to. But when it gets down to the details of how you do this, it's really, really important. And it has a lot of other negative side effects that we need to be aware of. And, you know, the bill as written, certainly, again, who doesn't want to protect kids? But the bill as written has got some serious problems. So I've got links in the show notes to several articles from the EFF about this and related bills, including the Online Safety Act as well. Joe mentioned that response to the Ofcom office in the UK about their bill. I've got a link to that as well. And also to the Santa Clara principles. I'd heard about that a long time ago, but never kind of followed up on it. So I was kind of curious when he mentioned it, jogged my memory. I went back and looked for it. And I'm interested to kind of read through that. I kind of skimmed it. But, you know, it looks interesting. It's always good to see people get together and try to propose, you know, ways forward on some of these things. I did look up the current status of the COSA bill. I originally thought it had passed the Senate, but what the article actually said was there were enough backers, in other words, at least 60, who have signed on to the bill, which means it should sail right through the Senate, because you need at least 60 votes to make sure you can get through all the Senate filibuster processes. So it looks like it's good to go in the Senate, though it hasn't passed yet. I did find that the House of Representatives has just put out a version of theirs for comment. I don't even think they've given it a number yet, an HR number. But just last week, it looks like they're kind of starting with the Senate bill, so they're going to be working on their own version. So at some point, when all that gets reconciled, there will be votes in the House and the Senate to pass it. And my guess is Joe Biden would sign whatever they pass. So if you have an opinion on this, now is the time to contact your representatives. The EFF has a great tool for determining who your representatives are and helping you contact them. I will put a link to that in the show notes as well. I've got some bonus content for the patrons on Thursday, as usual. Joe and I talk a little bit about the recent congressional grilling of social media CEOs and whether or not that was a worthwhile expedition. We talk about some intellectual property reforms and what they call COMCOM or competitive compatibility, the DMCA and their really weird process for granting exceptions. And we actually do talk a little bit about trying to find a better business model for the internet. So anyway, again, as usual, patrons will be getting that bonus content on Thursday. So I got a big catch-up news show for you next week since we missed one last week. So there'll be a lot of stuff I'm sure to catch up on there. And then I've got some other great interviews with Seth for Privacy and Dina Temple-Raston and Naomi Brockwell all coming down the pike. And some others that I'm in the process of working on that I don't want to jinx by telling you what they are. So again, the Treasure and Coin promo is going on till the end of this month. You got about 2 weeks. Go to fdsd.me/promo424 for all the information on that. Welcome to all the new patrons. Thanks for joining. Hope you enjoy your cool Dragon Challenge coins and your promo codes from either Proton or Malwarebytes or Portmaster. That'll do it for this week. Take care, everybody. Stay safe out there. And until next week, as always, don't get caught with your drawbridge down.